This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. It's really beautiful to see this, this full Zendo. And I see you all here and have you join us. Today is an auspicious day. You're here. But it's also auspicious because it's Buddha's birthday, or when we're celebrating Buddha's birthday at this temple. It kind of varies. From country to country, when we celebrate Buddha's birthday. In Japan, it's April 8th. Let's make it easy and efficient. That's Japan, yeah. This day. Most of the rest of Asia follows the lunar calendar. Sometimes Tuesday, sometimes next month, and it kind of moves around. I would say, as we're beginning here, I'm deaf. I can't hear. So that's why we have an interpreter with us. So if you don't understand something I'm saying, please just give me a little high sign. Give me a little wave. You don't understand me. That's okay. I'm happy to repeat myself. I like to say, I know I'm deaf. You're not offending me by saying, I don't understand. I say I don't understand all the time. So it's okay. Yeah? So, yeah, I'm really happy that we can be here and together to celebrate this. And so I'll talk a little bit about why this day is so important to us. But I also wanted to mention not just where we're going, but where we're coming from. Many of us in this room have just spent the last basically week together in silent meditation here doing a sesshin practice. Sesshin, I like to use the Japanese term because sometimes we say, oh, I'm going away on retreat. Oh, doesn't that sound so lovely? Good for you. You got to go away on retreat. Is there a spa there? Are you? There's some knowing smiles from people who just have been with us through since Tuesday. And we spent our whole day either in meditation, eating simple, nutritious meals together, or doing work. That was it. Simple, right? It's just simple. Just sit there. Just eat. Just clean up after yourself. Really simple. So I wanted to say a few words about our practice. What happened to us this week. What we were practicing with. What we're thinking about, as you all are kind of joining us. It feels like on the last day of this retreat, like you get to join us and then you get to celebrate with us. So I do hope that you're able to stay and spend a little time on campus here and stay a little longer and join us at 2 p.m. when we'll be having our big Buddha's birthday celebration. So that was what our theme also of our retreat. The theme of this session was Tanjo-e, which Tanjo means birthday. So it sounds like, you know, birthday. RSVP, will you be there? Will you bring cake? Mm-hmm. Will you bring toys? You know. But I also realized part of the reason I want to talk about what just happened is because I'm clinging to what just happened. We had a really lovely challenging at times, but a really lovely session together. And now you're here. And when we're all done, we'll all go down the mountain together. So here we come up the mountain for this kind of practice, you know. All week we're like this. But you have to go back. You have to return, right? At some point, even if you live here, even if you're a resident here, and you lived here many years, at some point, you have to descend the mountain. And our life is like this. Times of ascending the mountain. We'll come to Jokoji on a Sunday. Let's ascend the mountain. Let's practice together. And then we have to descend the mountain, which means we have to go back to the world and hopefully be able to share a little bit of the peace and equanimity of this space down at the bottom of the mountain. But of course, you don't need to have been sitting with us all week to realize the peace and equanimity that you find up here on this mountaintop is a peace and equanimity that you've always had with you, right? So during this session, we had three speakers, we had three teachers. I was guiding it, but I'm fairly young in Zen years. I'm not gray enough now. So I called in some really excellent support in my teacher and my Dharma sister, my teacher, Michael Shoho, Newhall Roshi, and my Dharma sister, Pamela, Nenzen Sensei. And I was, in reflecting and preparing a little bit for this talk, thinking about my experience and what things kind of hopped out, what things were really, had some juice for me, had some energy for me in the other speakers' talks. And in Shoho, in Mike's talk, he said a lot of really beautiful things and laid some really beautiful groundwork with a lot of Sanskrit and old stories and new stories. But what really hit me was something very simple, he said, in the middle of his talk. He said, when I breathe out, I try and let go. When I breathe in, I try and be open to receive. I don't think we need to say much more than that, you know? I feel, okay, maybe I'll end the talk here. Thank you, thank you. Yeah. It's not much more I need to say, right? All week, we're trying to open up and let it down. Being open to receive also means we have to be ready to let go, you know? And then Pamela Sensei, in her talk, said, in-breath, being born, out-breath, dying. In-out, in-out, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, like this. Is that the same teaching? Is that a different teaching? Born, dying, and really, it's the story also of Buddha's birth, which I promise I'll get to. That says, I believe that says, when he was born, we all were born. With his first big breath in, happy birthday, Buddha. We were also born, and we are also breathing in. And it's funny because a lot of our talks, we didn't communicate with each other, but there we were. We all were talking about the same thing. We were talking about our breath, our bodies, birth, death. But we all also came to certain stories in the Zen canon, in our collection. We all, one way or another, found Great Master Ma, who's called Baso in Japanese. But he was a Chinese monk back in the golden age of Zen in China. And in one of these stories, it's called, variously, it's either called Great Master Ma is unwell. Great Master Ma is unwell. Or it's called Sun-Face Buddha, Moon-Face Buddha. And it goes like this. Great Master Ma was unwell. The temple superintendent asked him, "Teacher, how has your venerable health been in recent days?" And the Great Master said, "Sun-Face Buddha, Moon-Face Buddha." What is he saying? What does that mean? One of the little details that Shoho Roshi pointed out was that the temple superintendent sounds like an important position, but it was actually a relatively low ecclesiastical grade. He was kind of nobody important. So all the monks said, "Oh my gosh, Master Ma, I think he's sick. I think the teacher is ill. I think he's ill." But they were all a little bit intimidated. They're all a little bit of afraid of the teacher. So they said, you go ask. I don't want to ask. You ask. You. So somebody must have tiptoed in and said, "Sorry, are you okay? You know, I don't want to disturb you." And what he said was, "Sun-Face Buddha, Moon-Face Buddha." I could imagine the superintendent coming back to all the senior monks and saying, "He said Sun-Face Buddha, Moon-Face Buddha." And them all going, "That's what he said? Are you sure? Did he say something else? Did he, you know, what does that mean?" So in our history, we know about this Sun-Face Buddha and Moon-Face Buddha. And the Sun-Face Buddha is a very strong figure. The Sun-Face Buddha, here they are, welcome Sun-Face Buddha, Moon-Face Buddha. And the Sun-Face Buddha is this very strong, eternal. There's a seat? Yeah, good. So the Sun-Face Buddha is this very strong, eternal, kind of never-ending, bright and radiant energy. Sometimes we have that, don't we? Sometimes we have that in our practice. We have this, feels good. Feels good to sit. Feels strong today. I'm going to sit like this. I can sit by myself on my own. I can hold myself up, you know. The Sun-Face Buddha lasts for thousands of kalpas. And a kalpa is the amount of time it takes for a world to be born and then to die. So you can imagine that Sun-Face Buddha, he's been around, or she's been around for a very, very long time. And then on the other hand, we have the Moon-Face Buddha. Moon-Face Buddha that lives for just one day and one night. So fleeting, so ephemeral. Sometimes maybe a little hazy, right? But we know it's there. So you can feel into what Master Ma was saying. He was saying, "Yes, I'm unwell. Sometimes it's like this. Sometimes we have great health, and sometimes we fall sick. he was also maybe expressing something a little deeper. Yeah. We all have this kind of eternal nature, but we also have these bodies, this finiteness, this temporariness, this hazy, flickering one day, one night nature. The great master Ma was a great master, and he was able to point really clearly and succinctly using words to help us. And that's not easy. It's not an easy thing to do. But that was one of Master Ma's favorite teachings, was to point out this kind of eternal quality of us. And that's something that all three of our talks also touched on, was that no amount of sitting is ever going to make us a Buddha. Oh, that doesn't sound too good. Sit as long as you like, as hard as you like. It's not how it happens. I told the story of actually when young Master Ma, before he was a great master, he was at a place like this. And his teacher, Master Ajo, saw Basso, saw young Master Ma, really sitting, trying to really, really sit, sitting a lot, sitting hard, just like we did all week, right? And Master Ajo said, "What are you doing over there, sitting like that?" And Master Ma said, "I'm sitting to become a Buddha. I'm here to wake up. I'm going to do it." Master Ajo said, "Okay." And he wandered away a little bit. And in the middle of the courtyard is a pile of cracked and disused roofing tiles, the terracotta tiles, you know, on the roofs of all these temples we see. So he picks up one of these tiles and he just... And I can see it. This is the way I picture it, at least. That Basso is there trying to be really good and trying to sit. And he's like, looking. I go, what is he doing? What's he doing? Polishing a roofing tile like that. So he couldn't help himself. And he says, "Master, what are you doing?" Oh, he says, "I'm polishing this roofing tile to make it into a mirror." And he says, I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can actually polish terracotta into a mirror. You know, that doesn't make any sense. And he says, "Just like you're sitting to become a Buddha, no amount of polishing, no amount of polishing." So you were probably like I when you first read this story, or you're first hearing the story, and it's like, okay, then what do I do? Because I thought that was the deal. I'll come here and I'll sit really strong, and I'll get it all figured out, and I'll cut away all this stuff I don't need, and I'll leave that deluded self behind. I'll finally get over myself. So Master Ma, or young little Ma, let's call him that, little Ma, little brother Ma, he says, "Okay, then if it's no amount of sitting, and what do I do? How do I aim at it?" tell me how I should be oriented. And he says, there's no amount of aiming at it that's going to get you there. Matter of fact, as soon as you aim at it, you're setting it further away from yourself. Just like me, grasping at the sesshin that just happened, or grasping at the cake that I might have at Buddha's birthday. So don't set up a goal. Don't set up a moon face and a sun face. Don't set up anything too far away. Because as soon as we set up a Buddha, we miss the Buddha that's there. I remember with one of my first Zen teachers, tell me, just like many of you receive today, you walk like this, you bow like this, you sit like this. And he said, we first bow to our seats, then we bow out. But the way he said it, he said, we bow to Buddha's seat first, and then we turn around and we bow to the assembly. And I remember thinking, I'm not sure I'm comfortable sitting in Buddha's seat. I didn't get it. We have a joke in my family that comes from the Irish that says, and we say, where shall you sit? And we say, well, sit where your mother sat when she was a bride. And you'd look at the table and say, where would my mother have sat when she was a bride? And then somebody says, on your butt. Just sit down. Just sit down. So we bow to our seat. We bow to our Buddha seat. And we take our whole self and sit down. We don't just take off our shoes and leave our water bottle and our phone and then maybe some of my fears and some of my anger and some of those icky parts of me, some of my shame, maybe some of my sin. No, we're not asking that. We're asking for all of us to show up as all of us. Because we need all of us. Every one of us has a Dharma position. Every one of us has a place. And it's needed. And you see that in Sesshin. For me, it becomes abundantly clear. And then makes me think about my home at the bottom of the mountain. Well, in my case, my home on the East Coast. And I see all of these parts coming together. I see an Amanda, I see a Miguel, I see these residents coming together. I see a cook, who by the way is up there cooking us a delicious lunch as we speak. He can't be here for the sit and for the talk, because he has his own Zendo run, he has his own temple up there, where he's harmonizing everything. Where somebody arrives with, as happened during our session, somebody arrives and said, my chickens made a lot of eggs this week. Can you use more eggs? The garden produced a lot of cherry tomatoes and a lot of kale. I think it's a requirement of a Zen temple, or at least a California Zen temple, a lot of kale. You have to have a lot of kale. Yeah? But that's how you cook. It's what the Tenzo Kyokun, Dogen's instructions to the cook, says. Right? It tells us, use all the ingredients of our life and make the supreme meal. What is that? What is the supreme meal? I don't know. Let me check the fridge. Let me see what's growing. Take all of those pieces together and put them in a big pot. We stir it up. And we offer it up. All of the parts of our life. Even those radishes that we don't like, or lima beans. Yeah, what's something we don't like? Well, the pain in my knee. I don't want that in the soup. I'm telling you, you do. I'm telling you, you need all of those parts of yourself. And so we've been talking about that, and we've been talking about this idea of Great Master Ma's other story of ordinary mind is the way. And we can hear where he picked up that thread from his teacher, Master Ajahn, polishing away. So don't aim for it, or you'll never hit it. A student came in to see me at Dokusan and said, well, I'm trying this and I'm trying that. And when I first started sitting, it seemed a lot more clear. And the more I've been sitting, and especially on this session, I'm having a lot of thoughts and thinking my thoughts about my breath and then thinking my thoughts about my thoughts about my breath. And it, does that sound familiar? And so I relayed a story about when I was younger, I was a competitive archer. I shot FIDE and Olympic style recurve archery. This is so not at any pretty little animals, but just at paper, just at targets, right? And something really interesting coming to this lineage and feeling like I can connect with Corbin somehow, with our founding teacher here, through his skillful use of the bow as a kind of moving meditation. Well, I wish mine was a moving meditation. Sometimes there's a lot more swearing and missing and training and sounds like sesshin. It's what we would do. I would get up, I would have this certain set distance, kind of like from me to the last building on the end, and I would fire 144 arrows. That was the amount in these groups that I would do every day. And there's something really weird that happens is that every once in a while, I think in baseball they call it the yips. You get in your own head and you can't pitch worth a damn. I don't know what happened. I just lost my mojo kind of thing, right? So in archery, it has a specific name. It's called target panic. Target panic, yeah? Because you're just there, staring at this bullseye that feels just a little too far away, a little too impossible to hit. And you miss. Okay, that didn't count. I do another arrow. Way off. Okay. Maybe it's my equipment. Okay. I just need another one of these. Fluff me out. Okay, now I'm set. I miss. Okay. That keeps happening. What's happening? Oh my God. I have target panic. And that's how it happens. That's how it happens. And my coach told me something really funny. He said, I've never met anybody who got target panic who hadn't already read about target panic. Yeah. If I never told you about target panic, you would just be shooting. Oh, I hit. Oh, I missed. But now you know, you got it bad. You're in the weeds. You got the yips. You're not going to hit that target no matter how hard you try. That's this kind of thing. So luckily, along with discovering target panic, somebody has discovered the solution for target panic. Some coach somewhere said, the solution is you stand this close to the target. You stand as close as you can comfortably shoot. And that's scary, actually. Have all this power and this big bow. Whack! Whack! Bow! All that energy into the target. You can't even focus on the bullseye when you're that close. You're just finding your body again. What is my body doing? Where am I? What a strange and silly sport I've dedicated my life to. What is going on here? And then you back up 5 feet and you just whack, whack, boom, boom. You back up a few more feet and again and again and again. So I asked my coach, what do you think target panic actually is? And, you know, waxed on philosophical about what it could be and, you know, physio, psychological. He said, I don't know. He said, the more I read about target panic, the more I know about target panic, the more I get target panic. So the best way is just to say, I don't know. I don't know anything about target panic. Boom. Boom. Just let your hours go. And you back up, you back up, you back up and go, oh, I guess I don't have target panic anymore. What was that about? So if you haven't done sesshin, that's also a description of sesshin practice. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to go sit. I'm going to take these practices with me. It's going to be like this. It's going to feel this way. My knee hurts already. My back hurts already. I don't think I want to be here, you know. And we watch ourselves go sun face, moon face, sun face, moon face. I've got this, I'm strong. I just spilled my tea. What a bad Zen student. Sun face, moon face. I hit, I missed. And that's the thing, it's target panic. We're so focused sometimes on what we're going to achieve. Enlightenment, of course. Some great experience. We get so focused on what we're going to achieve or what the whole point of it is that we totally miss the whole point of it. It sounds very Zen, doesn't it? You know, a thing is totally a thing, except where it's not. And that's how we should hold our practice. I'm not using this practice to attain any kind of realization. You know, just like Master Ma, sitting there. What are you doing with that roofing tile? Because no amount of sitting will ever make us a Buddha. Because we already are Buddha. And we don't use this practice to attain any realization. Because this practice is, it's more like remembering and expressing our realization. Expressing our Buddha nature. Before this session started, some of the residents and the teachers, we were hanging out at the breakfast table and talking away and getting all the talking out of our system, right? We were talking about this practice and then you know, all of this talk about attaining the way and attaining Buddhahood. And you could see some of the more seasoned practitioners kind of squirming. Attain? Achieve? I don't know, man. But what would you say? If not, getting the Buddha. Bullseye. What would you say? So we went around the table, kind of organically saying the different things. And, we were reminded of what Kwon-sama would say. He would say, return to Buddha. Right? He was fond of saying, return, return. It's, for me, I like that one. I always feel like I just wander a little bit. I just wander. And it's like one of those dogs on one of those really long leashes on a spool. And every once in a while, my teacher needs to go. So, yeah. I just make my way back. Some of us need a 5-foot lead. Some of us need a 20-foot lead. But just, I get yanked back from the East Coast. And I come, I have to practice with you. Oh, yeah. Sit. Stay. Good dog. You know, like this. So we're going around and sharing achieve, attain. What do we say? And Pamela Sensei offered up, recollect Buddha. To recollect Buddha. It's a really strong door to enter, to recollect Buddha. And that was our Spanish word for the day, recoger, to recollect, to gather ourselves back up. And that's Sesshin practice. We're going to come here and we'll gather up ourselves. We'll gather up our energies that we have let flow out onto really long leashes. And we've had all of these targets, these bullseyes, just on the other side of the mountain, just through the weeds, just beyond our sight. And we're firing wildly, trying to hit. If only I could just be that kind of Zen student, if only I could be that kind of person, that kind of partner, that kind of dog, then I'd be, and I'd have it. I'll get serious about my Zazen. I'll get serious about my practice when I get the mortgage taken care of, when I fix the car, when I get the bills off the table, then I'll sit Zazen. Just recollect our true nature. Just return. Just come home. Just bow to this seat, this Buddha seat. Maybe you're not convinced, but try it on for a little while. Try on the Buddha body. Or like when we're chanting in the morning. We're chanting the verse of the robe, the verse of the okesa. And they get asked, well, what if I don't have robes? Do I still chant? Yeah, of course. Go on. Express that with all of us, all together. But also, don't be confused. This doesn't make you more or less enlightened, or more or less good at Zazen. Because we need each of you and every part of yourself. So whether you put on a robe, heaven forbid, or you put on an all-black outfit to be our sign language interpreter, or you put on your apron to bake the loaves, that's your Buddha clothes. That's Buddha activity. Not just what happens in the Zendo, not just what happens with incense, but everything. So, if we're lucky, we remember this. And we sometimes get to do a little zazen together if we're fortunate. And then our zazen gets to get up and walk around. And in one of my talks, I think I said something to the effect of, don't make that Buddha anywhere, because you're going to miss all of the Buddhas, right? You're going to miss the Buddha in your seat. If you indulge me a little further, I also want to share some other really powerful teachings for me this week. And one of those teachings was, there's a big whiteboard, a marker board in the community room. And during our week of silence together, somebody started writing haiku, composing short verses, waka and haiku verse, on this board. And Sangha members being very strong and studious are walking, oh, and I'll add a verse. And I'll express my truth. And I'll turn the Dharma wheel. And I'll contribute. So some of them are really beautiful. So I wanted to share some of these teachings with you. And I love it because it's like we put all the ingredients in the pot and we stirred it up and then these little morsels, these little tastes of this expression of this Buddha field. So one of them said, "Hi, good morning, greed, hatred, and delusion. I never lack for company." "Hi, good morning, greed, hatred, and delusion. I never lack for company." All I could think of was, here is someone unstained with the three poisons, greed, hatred, anger, delusion, all that. And they're so intimate with it. You can't be stained if the target you're aiming for, you can't miss. Another one said, "Spring. The creek is singing. Daffodils are blooming. Tanjore is sitting." The Sesshin is sitting. The Sesshin is sitting. "Not ocean. I'm sitting. But look at this. The river courses on. Naturally, the grass grows by itself. The flowers bloom. And Tanjore, the Buddha's birthday, Sesshin, it sits." So it felt so fresh and alive to read some of these koans, read some of these rather haiku and short little verses rather. And it's been a strong theme for us. It's like this light that we have, this light that we all have, that we're here to realize, to recollect. And in my own case, I think sometimes it's just to get out of the way. The problem of being a really tall guy, too. I'm 6'4". Just get out of the way. But it's get out of the way and let your light shine. Get out of your own way and just let it shine. It feels really fresh when you say it that way. And so somebody said, one of these other little haiku, "Mindful is mindful. Worn out thinking just needs some ordinary mind." That's all it is. I just need a little bit of that ordinary mind. Just this guy with his achy back and his achy knee. No other Buddha than this one. That's what Master Ma said. He said, "Ordinary mind is the way." And he also said, "This very mind is Buddha." Those were two of his big famous teachings. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Millions and millions of aeons. And just this breath, they come together. And that was a big realization for me this week. I'm chasing sun-faced Buddha at the expense of moon-faced Buddha. In actuality, that light, that shining, you know, I was thinking about the kanji for brightness. I think it's the same in Chinese. When you take the sun and the moon together, ming, to make bright. So this is it. It's not sun-faced Buddha. It's sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. That's what's bright. That's the brightest of all. Not when we're leaving behind moon-faced Buddha. Not when we're leaving behind the one with the achy butt, the one with the achy back, the one with all his problems and his neuroses, the one that has strangely been thinking a lot about his cat 3,000 miles away, all session. And remembering all of these poems on the wall. This is a very organic thing. Just sometimes these very organic expressions just kind of bubble up. And it made me think about Huineng, who's the sixth patriarch back in China. Some of you already know poems on the wall, sixth patriarch. Some of you know where I'm going. But I want to say that reading about the sixth patriarch, who, by the way, at least historically, mythologically, wrote the Platform Sutra, which is the only text in the Mahayana canon, I believe, that we call a sutra that isn't Buddha's own words or some quotations of Buddha, at least in part. So we respect him, obviously. We think a great deal of him. But do you know that he was born illiterate, and grew up illiterate? Matter of fact, his father died when he was very, very young. And it left he and his mother destitute, completely poor and without. It's very hard in those days. Single mother. It's hard now. Can you imagine then? Unbelievable. And so Huineng became a woodcutter, which is basically a very low rung of manual labor, collecting scraps, collecting wood, chopping wood, delivering wood, hauling wood, chopping more wood. There wasn't a lot of opportunities for him. But going about in his day-to-day life, chopping and working, he heard somebody chanting, I believe it was a line from the Diamond Sutra. And hearing this, he had an awakening experience, and it completely changed his life. You know, joined the monastery, shaved his head, the whole thing. And just think about that deep suffering that he had, all of that pain and that effort, and losing a parent so young at such an impressionable age really must have deeply impacted him. Yeah, just like Buddha, who lost a parent very, very young. Maybe birth, while being the original blessing, to have a human body, to live in a lifetime and in a place where we can receive the teachings, where we can actually practice and hear the Dharma like this, that's a miracle. That's a good thing, right? But also with every birth is this intense trauma. It's our original trauma, the trauma of birth, the trauma to mother and baby. That also helps them form that mortal lock, going through that trauma together. And Dogen's story, and so on. All of this loss. They're not waiting for conditions to be right. Conditions weren't right. That's why they practiced. So the story with Huineng, he joins the monastery. And he's kind of relegated to almost like one of those superintendent roles we talked about. He's kind of like a kitchen monk. He's not even really that kind of a full monk. He's there, but nobody expects anything of him. He's an illiterate woodcutter. Now this temple with this monastery with its hundreds of monks, fine monks, some very learned monks that have been there a long time, who can compose excellent poems, who can say excellent words about the Dharma and all these sutras they've memorized and these teachings and commentaries. Well, when it became time for the abbot, the teacher of this monastery, to retire, he was getting close to the end of his life and his energy was waning, he was ready to name a new successor. And he said, I'm going to pick my successor like this. I'm going to look out at you hundreds of monks here, and I'll say, who's going to take up my robe and my bowl and the teaching seat will be the one that writes the best poem. Whoa. Today. Go up on that wall. Go on the marker board. Go on the dry erase board upstairs and express your awakened mind for us. And there was a very prominent monk. He was like the heir apparent. He was the would-be king. He was going to take it all over. Everybody knew it was going to be him. He's got it all together. He's been here the longest. He is the tallest. He's the shortest. He's the smartest. He's the bravest. Fill in the blank, right? He wrote this verse on the wall. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. At all times you must strive to polish it and must not let the dust collect. Pretty good, right? Pretty good. So, Huineng, I imagine him sweeping. I imagine him chopping wood, sweating away, sitting in the back of the zendo. And he said to somebody, what does this verse say? Can someone read this for me? He doesn't read and write. So somebody reads to him, the body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a clear mirror. At all times, we must strive to polish it. And we must not let the dust collect. So Huineng said, ah, that's pretty good. Can somebody write this for me, though? And one of the other monks that was brave enough took a brush and painted on the wall next to the first verse. Bodhi originally has no tree. The mirror has no stand. Buddha nature is always clean and pure. Where is there room for the dust to alight? So Bodhi, the awakened mind, originally has no tree. It's the unborn. It's the ordinary mind. And then he says, the mirror has no stand. That mirror-like mind rests nowhere, is everywhere, always reflecting. Buddha nature is always clean and pure, emptiness, oneness. When we have sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha together, there's nothing to stain. When you practice your whole self, when you bring your whole self to the cushion, to each breath. Where is there room for dust to alight? Where can the dust even collect? Here's another one from the marker board. Vowing no mistakes, I bump into everyone again and again. Here's another one. Pain in my knee. Sitting on the cushion. Are we there yet? And then there was a fun one. It looks to me like two different handwritings. I think throughout the week, someone wrote a line and someone wrote the next line. Someone wrote a line and wrote the next line. Just like our venerable monk and our illiterate woodcutter. Oh, let's play in the Dharma together, shall we? It said, top of the mountain, everything looks the same, except the sheet of clouds, the sheet of clouds. Come in. The water's fine. Swimming with a thermometer. It always tells the truth. Do you hear that? Ooh. It's so fresh and so alive for me. And we think about that. Oh, that pain in my knee. Oh. We think, oh, that's not expressing Sun-Faced Buddha. That's not expressing the eternal, unstained, pure. That's not Samyak Sambodhi. That's, what is that? You'd be wrong. Because as Bodhidharma, the first patriarch of Zen, said, every suffering is Buddha seed. Because suffering impels mortals to seek wisdom. But you can only say that suffering gives rise to Buddhahood. You can't say that suffering is Buddhahood. Your body and mind are the field. Suffering is the seed. Wisdom is the sprout. And Buddhahood, the grain. We think if I could get through and get over my suffering, then it will all be better. And we forget that. Where are Buddhas born? We'll find out later today, won't we, at 2 p.m. Where are Buddhas born? They're born right here. They're born in this realm, not dancing with the devas or somewhere else beyond our reach, like a target on the other side of the mountain. They're born right here. Right now, with all our suffering. Well, I'd like to finish up by talking a little bit about Buddha's birth and the story, this most excellent story. So if you'll indulge me, it's now story time. So I always look, and I think the last consensus with scholars is that Buddha's birthday was somewhere around 623 BCE. It was about 600 some odd years before zero. And if we do the math, I think that works out to be 2,646 years today. So a long time ago, 2,646 years ago, in an ancient kingdom in the mountains, what is now in the country of Nepal, in the Lumbini Valley, there was a king and a queen. And the queen was called Queen Maya. And one night while she was pregnant, she had a very vivid dream. In her dream, a white elephant with six tusks approached her in her dream and reached its trunk out and touched her on her side. When she woke up, she knew this dream was really special. She knew that it had real weight, so she decided to bring her dream to the wise men, to the holy priests, and said, "Help me interpret my dream." And these men determined that this dream was an auspicious sign, very auspicious indeed. And they told her that the son that she was pregnant with would either be a great ruler or a great spiritual leader. Either way, would be the king of kings. And when it came time for her to give birth, she followed the tradition of that time, of her culture, which was to return to her mother's home. So they left the kingdom of Shakya, and they made their way to the Lumbini Valley. And you picture this royal palanquin, you know, they had probably had her up on a chair, and they were shouldering her and carrying this pregnant woman, you know, through very hilly, rocky terrain into this lush valley where they're trying to go back to her parents' home to give birth to this baby. But before they could reach their home, she went into labor early. So the procession had to stop right where they were, right where we are, right here. And they had to lower her down. And the Queen Maya walked into the forest. And as she walked into the forest, all of these animals started to appear and started to follow her. And as she began to have her labor pains, the trees that surrounded her started to bend down and offer their branches for her to hold on to. And she did. She held on to them, and she gave birth standing up. I'm thinking about all these animals and all of these trees and the great earth and everything coming together in this moment. And I'll read you one last poem from up on the board. All sentient beings possess the same nature, so you should cherish your relationship with each one of them. Here they come, all of these beings into Jikoji, into your life. So she delivers this baby standing up. And in some versions of the story, the Buddha even came from her side where she was touched in the dream. No matter what, soon, a beautiful baby boy was born. Almost got you guys. You're in the cheap seats. And another wonderful part of the story is after she gave birth, the Buddha, not yet the Buddha, just a little baby boy, immediately stood up and began walking. And he took seven steps. And in some traditions, each one of his steps, of those seven steps, a lotus appeared and perfumed. And a great dragon came down from the heaven and showered him and bathed him. And after his seven steps, Buddha, with one hand pointed to the heavens and one hand pointed down to the earth, said, "I alone am the world honored one." And that is how the great enlightening being was born into this world. So yes, this story is a little bit amazing, as all good stories are. And in celebrating this event, don't fall into this trap that, we're having a party for someone who lived 2,500 years ago. Because that would only be part of it, right? Because to deeply understand this event is to understand what really happened that day spiritually. And while many of these stories are a myth, there was an actual man born around that place, around that time. And he did indeed grow up to be a really powerful person. And he had a deep effect on the whole world. So the dream was right. So what was born that day, 2,500 years ago, was indeed a prince body, the body of a prince. But also the Buddha was born, an awakened body was born. So you could say, oh, this is my party too. This is my birthday too. And you'd be correct. Because I like to say that what happened that day was, what was born other than a really deep compassion for the world and a really deep wisdom and awakening to truth? These were the two things that were born. And we can see how this really interesting story about his birth in the next chapter, just 1 week after he was born, Queen Maya dies. And the sister takes over, Maha Prajapati, the first female nun, takes over to raise the Buddha. We can see how all the trees and the animals and everything comes together. We can see how all of our parts and all of our families come together. And if we slow down and we practice, we can notice this. See and notice and feel all of those connections. And then we get to start to act like it, to actually behave. It's like we're all connected. So how does that feel, knowing that? How does it feel knowing that your realization will nourish others and will have a great effect on others? Seeing all those special circumstances of our life and not trying to practice to get beyond them, get around them, get over them, but to bring them in. And then we start to see Buddha born in our children, in our neighbors, in the creek, in the daffodils, in the turkeys, you hear them calling all morning. It's a kind of deep and wonderful and powerful knowing. So of course, we need to celebrate. So to close, one little quote with Dogen, because I can't give a Dharma talk without at least one little quote of Dogen, because that's our way. And Dogen in the Ehe Koroku, in his Dharma Hall Discourses, it's number 42, he has to say this about this day, about this birth. He says, when we're sitting with our whole selves and completely manifesting this moment, we're not sitting to achieve our Buddhahood, we are in fact expressing it, right? So he says, if we are not obstructed by mountains or oceans, or targets, or turkeys, or daffodils, if we're not obstructed by birth, all the people in the entire earth and the entire universe are born together with Shakyamuni Buddha and say, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone am the Anagon. After taking seven steps in the 10 directions, that means every which way, up, down, left, right, forward and backward, past, present, future, all of it, and every step we take. How do you express such a manifestation? How do you express it? So, with tenderness, let's enjoy and explore this awakening we have together, and we'll have a really lovely lunch and a really lovely party. And we'll get to bathe the baby Buddha together. Thank you, everyone, for your practice.
You can look at page 2.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.